This is a Stand Up Labs production, powered by digital media.
On this week's episode, we're talking about an update in the Freddie Gray case, Chelsea Manning, Guantanamo Bay, bad news on gun control, and the first installment, Joey, of Emails from a Hat. You excited?
Emails from a Hat.
Obviously he is. Stick around. This is the Mandatory Samson Podcast. Oh, coming to you live from Stand Up New York Labs in New York City. It's not really live, but I say it anyway. Hello, everyone. My name is Christopher Flenner. I'm joined, as always, by Joseph Anthony Noe III. Hi, Joey.
Hi, Chris. Great start, baby.
Thank you. Feeling it, bro. Feeling it. Evan, thank you for producing the show over there.
What up?
Whew. I'm telling you what, guys. Good energy in the room. I'm in a very good mood. It's warm in the city, so I'm feeling loose. We got a nice show lined up. We're going to have to get serious in a minute, Joey, but I'm in a very good mood, and I feel like you are, too.
Yes, I am.
I'm very excited to do the show.
You want to know why I'm excited?
Of course, yeah.
Game on.
What is that? What?
Bernie Sanders and Trump will be debating before June 7th.
What are you talking about?
You didn't hear about that?
No. Joey, breaking news to me right now. What are you talking about?
There's going to be a debate between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Nope. It's happening.
That's official?
Yeah, it's as official as two people saying it's going to happen on Twitter.
Oh, so not official at all. Don't do that. I was extremely excited. I was going to say that is unprecedented. That is insane.
Is.
Could you imagine?
It's trending on Twitter right now.
There's 0% chance that shit's going to happen. But okay. I just got really excited for a second. All right. Hi everyone. Welcome to the show. We're going to run through a number of topics today, including another dismal verdict in the Freddie Gray case.
No.
Chelsea Manning. Mm-hmm. Guantanamo Bay update, a good one, pretty good. Joe Biden's bad news on gun control, an update on the NFL and paid patriotism, which is something we talked about a number of times in the podcast a while back.
Yeah,
it's an update there. We're going to get into it, and an interesting 2016 update. Plus, at the end of the show, we're going to do our first installment of Email in a Hat.
Emails from a Hat.
It's Emails from a Hat?
Yeah, I like that better.
All right, emails. I'm going to make a note right now. Emails from a Hat. We're going to close the show with that. We've talked about it the last couple of weeks. We're getting a lot of emails. They take up a lot of time on the show. Not that they're not good emails. They certainly are, and I appreciate the support. But in the interest of time, we're just going to read one email at the end of each episode. We'll probably have enough to do that every week. Evan has a hat, a NASA hat, which I enjoy.
It's pretty cool.
It's very cool. He's going to throw numbers in the hat.
Ooh.
I've numbered the emails that we got.
Okay.
And we're going to pick a number out, obviously, and that's the email we're going to read. All the emails that aren't read and all the emails we get the next week and the week after, they're going into the pile. And
nice.
Then we're just going to, so we'll be picking out of a huge number of emails, and that's how we're going to do it.
I like it.
Sounds good. Well, it was your idea. Of course you like it. We got an update about Saudi Arabia lawsuits at 9/11. But first, I wanted to start with the big news of the week. Obviously, Johnny Depp is getting divorced.
That's sad. Why are you laughing? I just want Amber to be happy.
I'm just kidding. I mean, I wanted to, you know, everybody that got mad about the Kim Kardashian stuff was just like, come on!
So now you're going to upset the fans even more.
I'm playing with you guys. I'm in a good mood. No, I'm not going to talk about it. Evan, what? You had something to say about this?
I thought we were going to talk about it.
Evan perked up immediately. No, we're not going to get into it. Look, good luck, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. I got to tell you this. Johnny Depp, seen him interviewed a few times recently. He's getting weirder and older, Depp. I mean, I'm a big Depp fan, but he's getting odd.
He's starting to become those roles.
Absolutely. He's starting to become, yeah, like sort of a character of himself, you know, which ends up happening. Okay, anyway.
Which Johnny Depp did she marry?
No, I'm not. It started as a
hands?
Joke. We're not doing
come
this.
Come on.
No, okay. No, we need to get serious here. Here's okay. Why. Because we got a lot of stuff to get through. I don't want the episode to be 5 hours, but I feel like it's going to be probably longer, even though try to make them a little shorter. I was reading an article in The Guardian. It was an op-ed piece by this woman, Donna Marsh O'Connor, and it caught my eye because it was something we talked about last week, and it was like an interesting discussion we had about lawsuits and regarding Saudi Arabia and 9/11. Mm-hmm. Donna Marsh O'Connor, her daughter was killed on 9/11, and she wrote an opinion piece, like I said, in The Guardian last Friday. And I have some of her quotes in the email. We can listen to what her thoughts are about it.
Okay.
And then I have a couple of questions sort of to just to guide the conversation afterward. Donna Marsh O'Connor in The Guardian about the lawsuits in Saudi Arabia. When the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, which is JASTA, which is the act that we were talking about, which the Senate passed this week, was first conceived, it was to allow relatives of 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia for damages in U.S. courts, to bankrupt terrorism, so that any entity that funded my daughter's death would lack the capital to strike again. The bill still needs approval from the House, and the Obama administration has threatened to veto it. They shouldn't. Now, I skipped ahead. She wrote like a long article. I skipped ahead a little bit. The attacks also had indirect effects on the finances of an entire generation. This is interesting. This just gets into her logic about why she thinks these should happen. On the day my daughter left Earth, she left two brothers and a nation in mourning. A nation tanked emotionally, morally, and financially. That's true. Make no mistake about this. Part of the demise of the economic prosperity that once characterized middle-class America comes from endless war and bottomless greed. Can't argue with her there. Absolutely right. This lawsuit would give back funds to the victims' families, fiscal autonomy. I want that for my sons. I want them never to worry about their student loans, never to worry that they might want to study something to do some good in the world. Okay, I hear that. And her rationale about the lawsuit is that this is something that we can actually, like, it's not a form of justice necessarily. It's not going to bring her daughter back. It's not going to, you know, is Saudi Arabia really going to feel this? But in her mind, this is something that she can get economic justice, essentially. And it might also keep Saudi Arabia from funding terrorism, as is alleged in these, you know, still missing 28 pages from the report. For our purposes, she finishes, I believe there will always be money for terrorism when there is a motive. I am under no illusions that this suit would bankrupt anything, but there should be justice meted out in courts, and those culpable for the manipulation of lives and deaths ought to pay in every and any way possible. Comfort comes not in empty promises of goods and services, but in the enactment of the American system of jurisprudence. Our family members and their murderers should meet in open court. Joey, thoughts on this?
The thing that was shocking to me.
Yeah.
About this, when I read it, was the fact that the hijack was wired back all unused money back to Saudi Arabia
before they carried out the attacks.
Yes,
yeah. What she says in the op-ed, obviously we didn't read the whole thing, but right. But she said one of the most chilling things was that it came out in documents that right, if they weren't using money on the attack, or they knew that they weren't going to be using it anymore because they were going to die, they sent it back.
Sent it back,
so they would have it for later attacks or whatever.
Which is unbelievable.
I mean, it's not unbelievable, but it's certainly, you know, it's sinister, right? It's like, that's what they're doing. Like, they are an organization, and I'm glad you brought that part up, because I actually have a couple of questions to kind of wrap this conversation up. It's organized. They are a, you know, terrorist, and particularly ones that are successful, like 9/11 is, you know, it's one of the most successful terror operations ever. Of course, there's a high level of planning and there's a high level of sophistication, and that involves penny pinching. I mean, it sounds insane, but it's like, that's how a good business or a good operation is run. And so that's why they do it. It's not shocking. I mean, you know, but it's how they ran the operation. So, you know, I was gonna say it's impressive. It's not impressive, but that level of coordination is stuff that, you know, that is actually the troubling things that we need to pay attention to.
Yes. And also, if this actually does not get veto and show some validation that, hey, we're taking as much action as we can economically to prevent that from happening again, would help.
Yeah, I don't think it will be vetoed. I doubt it's going to pass anything. And I read an article in the Post, but I you know, the New York Post. I can't just go by that. I couldn't find it anywhere else. So I'm putting that caveat out that I couldn't find another source for it. But in the Post, it said that Chuck Schumer added an amendment to the bill that, you know, provides a lot of different like appeals processes, and like the Secretary of State can veto even lawsuits that do proceed and all this stuff. Okay. So again, I don't trust the New York Post on its own, but I'm just putting that out there as an idea. I don't think this is going to go anywhere. I think it's a big symbolic thing. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting to hear from somebody that actually is obviously personally affected by it and, you know, her thoughts about it. Now, these are my questions, and we'll just wrap up with this. Mm-hmm. Terrorism is defined as fourth generation warfare and violent crime. Okay, that's how it's defined. Should we be treating terrorism as a crime rather than an act of war? Is ISIS the mob or is it an army? We tend to look at terrorist groups as something that we need to go after militarily. There's a lot of reading that can be done, and I've read a lot of articles and different things, people's opinions about this, where you should really be treating, and the reason why this came up is because you said, you know, they're sending the money back. They're not trying to waste money. Yeah, that's a mafia type maneuver. You know, that's a business move. So that's more crime to me. And it's even defined that way. It's defined as violent crime, but it's crime nonetheless. Shouldn't we be kind of going after them with police work, with, you know, treating it more like a criminal act, criminal actors, as opposed to soldiers or, you know, a country that we could go to war with? I think that makes more sense strategically, no?
Well, to me, it really shouldn't matter what you call it, a mob or an army, but every resource that is available should be used.
Well, yeah, I mean, but here's the thing. Is that really true? Should we really be deploying the military into the Middle East to go fight a group, essentially a small business? You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. I understand your point that you call it whatever you want. You can call it Muslim extremists, or you can call them, you know, whatever, that whole stupid argument. But it is orienting in the sense of, if we're referring to ISIS as an army, or, you know, we're at war with ISIS, as opposed to this cell, this mob that exists, it does orient you whether you're going to attack it criminally or as a military. You know, and I think that's an important distinction to make. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
I honestly don't think it makes a difference, because when you send in the drone strike to get them, that's a drone strike.
But that's an act of war.
Yeah.
You know, it's a quasi act of war. And I mean, you know, that's the whole controversy about the whole, you know, the drone thing. It is okay. Go ahead.
All right. So what it comes down to is, if you do send the drone in to kill the mob,
right,
does Saudi Arabia then say that's an act of war and go to war with us?
Well,
they don't.
Right. Well, I'm not even talking about specifically Saudi Arabia, but I'm just saying, like, sure. I mean, that's something that would come out. I don't think we would drone strike somebody in Saudi Arabia. That's the thing.
No, I think you can.
Right. But say we were doing it in Iraq or Afghanistan. Like, we the reason why I bring it up is because this woman is bringing up the point of, like, you could take their money away, you know, take the stream away so they won't be able to finance the stuff. That's the thing. Like, when we go and blow up ISIS's cash, is that war? Is that a war maneuver? Or is that how you would go after the mob? Cut off their sources of income and literally find out where their source of income is a pile of cash over there, and you blow it up. You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, you can read a lot more about that, but to me, I think treating terrorism generally as criminality as opposed to war, or like an act of war, I think is probably a better strategy in the long run, because you're going to lose a lot less blood and treasure fighting it that way. And also, it's following clues. It's not destroying everything and we're going to, well, carpet bomb. Oh, good, Tech Riz, we'll just destroy everything. But if you go in there and you're able to kind of interdict their finances and get involved, then maybe you can find a pattern and see the patterns of use and things like that. While language doesn't always matter, putting the right frame on something does kind of affect the way that you go about stopping a potential crime, you know?
Yes. And the best way to frame it would be to send in people that are able to detain such individuals and get them to be, I guess, thrown in prison. So that way you don't make them martyrs.
Sure.
Because if you do drone strike and kill a bunch of them, then you're going to have a whole nother complete generation that hates America, and you just keep on providing terrorism to exist.
Yeah, you give them ammunition, absolutely. And rightfully so in a lot of cases. I mean, who's going to argue with the fact of, like, Joey's a terrorist, I blow up his house, and I killed his wife, his 8 kids, his 3 cousins, and all the neighbors saw it. Like, of course they're going to be mad about that. It doesn't matter that, like, Tony Soprano's family is going to be mad if he gets killed. They're going to be upset about it. They don't care that he's a technically a criminal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Same idea. You're absolutely right, Joey. But anyway, okay. Interesting update about that. I want to move on to this next story, one that we've covered a bunch in the podcast, and I guarantee we will be covering again on this podcast. It's Edward Nero and Freddie Gray. On Monday, Baltimore Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams acquitted Officer Edward Nero of 2 counts of misconduct in office, reckless endangerment, and second-degree assault in connection with the arrest and death of then 25-year-old Freddie Gray. He is the second of 6 officers to be tried. Both of them have gotten off so far. This guy was acquitted, and the first one, William Porter, it was a hung jury, and they couldn't convict him of anything. It was a deadlock. So Caesar Goodson, who is the driver in the Freddie Gray case, goes on trial next. And from what I've read, a lot of people, a lot of cops that have been interviewed have said that the driver is the one responsible for buckling in the passenger. And now just to quickly recap, obviously we've talked about it a lot. Freddie Gray was detained for basically no reason. He made eye contact with the police and then ran, and then they chased him down. We don't really know what happened before they got him into the van, but obviously he was in pain. They put him in the back of a police van, did not buckle him in. His hands were cuffed. And then somehow later he had a broken spine. So that's what happened. And so now these two guys have not gotten any kind of punishment, and we'll see what happens with the driver. But yeah, they're right now the blame is being put on the driver, that it's his job to buckle Freddie Gray in, that potentially would have prevented this accident from happening. Good.
Well, the other thing that the judge did cite is the fact that there was testimony from a police academy trainer who said Nero did not receive required training on how to put a seatbelt on a detainee.
That would explain probably why he didn't do it. But that isn't on him then.
Correct.
Because he can't be found guilty of something that nobody in charge told him to do. You know what I mean?
But my question is, does this set precedence for the next case? Because to me, it seems like as the two trials are going, they'll seem to be throwing Oscar underneath the bus.
Caesar,
excuse me.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think they're setting the stage. I mean, look, there's probably a 50-50 chance that someone is going to go to jail over this. Mm-hmm. Maybe less than that. It might be 60-40. Nobody's going to go to jail. But I think if somebody is going to be, it's going to be Caesar, the driver, and then potentially, one of the other 3 officers that are still yet to be charged. We'll find out. But these two seem like the least, I don't want to say guilt. That's not what I mean, least guilty, but like the least culpable, I guess, so far. But we'll see what happens.
Quick question, not overanalyzing or just thinking. But if you were to throw somebody into the back of a van and there are 6 people, wouldn't one of them just strap them in? You would think?
Well, part of what the judge said, and what's interesting is that Edward Nero waived his right to a jury trial, so he got a judge. Mm-hmm. So you actually get a written rationale of why the judge ruled
the way
he should be acquitted. And I actually have a clip of Billy Murphy, who's the lawyer of the Gray family, which I found interesting. I want to play that. In the response, the judge said, what was your point? I'm sorry, but I lost track of what I was saying.
Okay, very simple. There were 6 people around. Why wouldn't just one person hop back in?
In his response, he was saying that under the circumstances, he could understand. Like, he was trying to figure out, in this circumstance, would a normal officer have buckled him in? And he found no, probably not.
See, I disagree with that, because if the primary job of a police officer is to protect and to serve.
Yeah.
They're not protecting him.
No, they're not. They're not, but what the judge was saying, and I'm not defending it, I'm just saying what the judge said. I think it's absurd. It's going to be highly absurd if nobody goes to jail over this. Freddie Gray is an innocent man that, wakes up that day and has no idea that he's never going to fucking go to sleep peacefully. He's dead. He's never going to go to sleep peacefully that night. It's a travesty if nobody can be found guilty on anything here. And it's very telling. to the point, the judge was saying, you know, there was a lot of like kind of chaos going on there. People were yelling, whatever. They probably feared for their safety. So to throw him in the van and run was probably something that most officers would do. He didn't find that particularly malicious behavior.
Yes, but when an email was sent no more than 3 days prior to this incident, that there was a new direct order saying that the cops are responsible to seatbelt detainees in, should it not put even more emphasis that the police department knew that this was happening?
Probably. I agree with you. Yeah.
Sent it out, and then there's no accountability.
I completely hear you. I'm going to read this quote, and then we're going to play the lawyer for Freddie Gray's family. And you'll understand why I brought that. That makes it interesting. David Yaros, who's University of Baltimore law professor, says he was, quote, not shocked by the verdict and that, quote, prosecutors had a very steep hill to climb and, quote, just because it doesn't rise to the level of being criminal doesn't mean that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a question of, well, did they do this? Is it illegal that they did this? The judge is saying no. Is it not proper protocol? Probably. But does that mean that they did it and they should be in jail because they did that? According to the judge, no. And I want to read, and again, I just said it, I disagree. I think clearly somebody needs to be held accountable for this. This is the Gray family attorney, Billy Murphy, after the verdict.
The family's reaction is going to be, I predict, the same reaction that they've had to the entire process. And that is, justice doesn't have guilty beside its name, nor does it have not guilty. It is whatever it is if there is a thoroughly fair process where all of the evidence is considered and the law is fairly applied. And I want to commend Judge Williams for not bowing to pressure and basing his decision on the objective circumstances of this case and a thorough examination of the applicable law. He was outstanding in his erudition today. And I'm proud that he's on this bench because judges should have the ability to reject public opinion routinely as the basis for their opinion. And he showed that tremendously today. He did the public a service by doing something that juries are incapable of doing. He articulated every aspect of this case that he thought was significant. And he articulated every instance of his legal reasoning that created the result that we heard today. That is commendable. And hopefully people who are in the mood to protest his decision, who have not yet read his excellent opinion, will do that first. And then make a decision about whether or not they thought the outcome was fair. And I'll make a prediction. If you can read, you'll be satisfied.
So that's interesting. Now, that is Freddie Gray's lawyer, like his family's attorney. And he's saying, you know, he's giving the judge a lot of credit. And he's saying that this is probably the proper outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I find that interesting. I find that fair. I mean, I find that reasonable that he's not going to like go out there and pretend that the judge did something completely insane. The question then becomes, why are the laws? I mean, The impulse is to want to protest that and to say that somebody needs to go to prison. I think somebody will or should, right? Somebody's got to be found responsible for this. This kid shouldn't be dead. But I think the flip side of it, if the judge, there's only so much a judge can do. If that's the law, like if that's the letter of the law and he can, and they can present a case that doesn't make you throw this guy in a jail cell for the rest of his life, then it is what it is. Like he has to do that. And so it's interesting that Freddie Gray's lawyer is commending him on, you know, being a good judge essentially and reading the case and following the facts. So, you know, that to me, that at least, you know, gives you hope that if something is going to be done, the judge will do the right thing in that case as well. You know,
there's two more things that I don't get.
Okay.
First thing is the fact that the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, who brought the charges against Nero and the other officers, didn't even bother showing up to the verdict.
Right. Well, what's the matter?
What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, it tells you that she didn't, well, it could tell you a couple of things. It could tell you she didn't think it was going to go in her favor, right?
Mm-hmm.
If she brought the charges, obviously her favor would be, you know, this guy actually going to jail because that's why she brought the charges to begin with. Or it could be as simple as she didn't want to turn it into a more political, you know, spectacle than it already is, kind of. So, but right, but you can read into that either way you want.
So with the way this case went,
yeah,
it looks like they're setting up two possible fall guys.
Yeah.
One is the driver.
Caesar Goodson.
Or the supervising officer who would be... One second. Where did I put it?
Oh, Joey, you're doing such a good job.
But... I know. It's okay. The other thing that doesn't make sense to me is the fact that they had someone testify under limited immunity, Miller.
Yeah.
So how can he give testimony but be immune and it can't be used against him?
Well, because it's like he's one of the other cops, is that what you're saying? Because they want him to be able to give testimony as an eyewitness, but they also don't want him to incriminate himself before his own trial. So it's, you know, there's special circumstances. I get that. There's special circumstances. So I don't exactly know what the restrictions are there as far as limited immunity is concerned, but I understand that it's more valuable to have him get on the stand and actually answer some questions and like be on the record as opposed to him not doing it at all. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I understand why they'd want him there. But anyway, okay. Any other thoughts on this?
Yeah, and it's Lieutenant Brian Rice who would be the supervising officer.
Right. He was one, I think, that we mentioned when this all first started, that he has a bit of a history.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, look, 2 of 6, 4 more to go. We'll see, you know, what ends up happening here. It's a story we just got to keep our eyes on. It's something that we've covered pretty much right from the beginning. So, obviously, we'll stay on top of it. Mm-hmm. All right, here's what I want to get into. Chelsea Manning, one of my favorites, somebody mm-hmm. that put out a lot of documents to WikiLeaks and everything, is formally appealing her, quote, grossly unfair and unprecedented, close quote, 35-year sentence for leaking documents to WikiLeaks. She leaked about 700,000 documents to WikiLeaks.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. I bring it up all the time. The collateral murder video is something that I think was extremely important for me to form my ideology about foreign policy and American interventionalism and the Middle East in different places. It's a disturbing video, but I think it's an important one to see, and especially important in a democracy where we're just going to support these endless wars. Let's know what that actually looks like, and let's not pretend that this is something noble and heroic when it's really kind of a horrific thing that we're doing. Not that the troops themselves are these like barbarians, but in this video there's a callousness demonstrated that I think is tends to come out when you are at endless war and you stop seeing the people that, you know, there is no exact clear mission. It's just sort of like, these are all bad people. Like, we don't need to be, you know,
they're not even humans anymore.
They don't become, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. I have a quote from the brief in the email, and then Nancy Hollander, who's one of Manning's attorneys. I have two quotes here. This is from the brief itself. Manning disclosed the materials because under the circumstances, she thought it was the right thing to do. She believed the public had a right to know about the toll of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the loss of life, and the extent to which the government sought to hide embarrassing information of its wrongdoing. Right. Mm-hmm. Nancy Hollander, who's one of the attorneys, said, "A war against whistleblowers is being waged in this country, and this case represents how this country treats anyone who reveals even a single page of classified information. We need brave individuals to hold the government accountable for its actions at home and abroad, and we call upon this court to overturn the dangerous precedent of Chelsea Manning's excessive sentencing." Chelsea Manning was sentenced to 35 years. Mm-hmm. She's hoping to reduce that sentence to 10 years. And then listen to this. This is what's really interesting. It kind of puts it in perspective. The next harshest penalty for a comparable crime, Joey, mm-hmm. is 14 years in Canada. That's the longest you can get for something very similar to what Chelsea Manning did. So 14 years is the longest you can get anywhere else. It's the most amount you can get. 35 years is what Chelsea Manning got. Plus the amount of like degrading, horrible, solitary confinement, strip search, sleep deprivation, all this stuff that Chelsea Manning endured prior to even being charged. You know, it's like, that's got to factor in, and you know why they're doing it. They're doing it because this person, you know, used her conscience to try to tell her fellow American citizens the way Snowden did and any of these people do. You know, they're punishing her for that because they don't want that to be the case.
Yes, but the major issue with this is the fact that it's military justice. it's not the same thing as a civil court. So she's kind of pretty much screwed.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens. I think you're right, probably to an extent, but what is she going to do, not appeal it?
No, she's going to appeal it, but I don't think... I think it's much harder to navigate the military justice system than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, it certainly is. Right. I mean, there's... To me, there's question marks about why we even need a military court in general. Like, why is the military...
Well, because she was a... She was a soldier at that current moment when she
I understand why she's is in a military, but I'm saying I don't even know why we need that. It's the same thing as like with terrorism and all this stuff. Like, just try to just do a civil. We have a system. Let's just use that system. Fine. Obviously, we're not going to overturn the military tribunal setup. But right, yeah, it's a much more stringent, difficult process for sure.
And also the kicker in this one is a jury of your peers would be other soldiers, which would be the military justice system.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting about it, it's like if you want to get really specific, it's like transgender 25-year-olds who are also in the army that are, you know, that are whistleblowers. You know, it's like she
can't. That would be interesting.
Well, right, but she really can't get exactly a jury of her peers. Because it's the same argument. You know, like the jury is not really reflective of the person that's on trial, unless they are really from the same place and the same upbringing and the same socioeconomic, you know, all these factors. So yes, on the basis of like, yeah, we're all humans in America, then yes, yeah, it's a trial of my peers, but not really, you know, it's a very broad brush that gets painted with. So, yeah. So anyways, that's something I wanted to put out there. I really hope they reduce that amount of time. Again, Chelsea Manning is somebody the same way I feel about Snowden. That person is way more valuable to all of us in a democracy as a free person and somebody that can put their thoughts out there and be a, you know, be a guide for other people that maybe were feeling stuck in their situation and knew that they had to do the right thing.
And chose to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's again, something that we should revere in this country and not something that we should punish or, you know, demonize. All right, let's do one more. Mm-hmm. Then we'll take a quick break and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Joe Biden on gun control, the paid patriotism stuff, the 2016 update. And then we're going to close with emails from a hat. Is that correct?
Yes. Emails from a hat.
Yeah. I have a little song, you know, that I'm probably going to make up on the spot when we get there. So we'll you stay tuned for the end of the program for emails from a hat. Guantanamo Bay update, Joe. You ready for this shit?
Yep.
The Obama administration has deals in place to ship 22 or 23 detainees to about 6 countries, further reducing the total of 80 men still held there. I'll save this phrase for a second because it might be the title of the show. 28 of the 80 remaining detainees at Guantanamo Bay are approved for transfer. So 23 of them getting, you know, released gets that number down to 5 people who are cleared for release left. Mm-hmm. The rest of those people, they're not going anywhere. And the Obama administration is working towards, quote, an irreducible minimum.
How does that even mean?
It means they literally cannot get rid of these people. There's nothing we can do with them. We don't have enough evidence to actually try them. Uh-huh. We can't release them, though, because we know that they're dangerous. Like, we're pretty sure that they are a problem, but we can't prove that. So they are stuck in this gray area of like, well, you're just here now. There's nothing to do with them. Write down irreducible minimum. I like that potentially as a title. Thoughts on that? I mean, irreducible minimum is so far from the idea of hope and change. It's like, I was just laughing, like, reading that phrase last night because it's not...
That's the exact opposite.
Man, it's just like such a, it's what we can do.
What's it called again?
An irreducible minimum.
Irreducible minimum. You know the guy Frank Lutz or the guy?
Yes, Frank Lutz from Fox News or whatever.
Sounds like something he would have come up with.
Absolutely. It's instead of calling it shell shocked, it's, you know, PTSD. It's like just changing the, not that PTSD isn't a real thing, but you know, it's like changing the phrase. Thoughts on this, Joey? Good news, bad news?
It's not enough.
Well, what do you want? Okay, well, here we go.
He wants to close it.
Yeah.
They're not going to let him close it. Right. So they come down to, how many people is it? 5, 6? No, 20, right?
Well, there's 80 people there. They're trying to get 22 to 23 shipped out. 28 of the 80, which includes that 23 that they're going to get rid of are cleared for release.
Okay.
So if they get rid of everybody that's cleared for release, they're left with like 52 people in the prison.
That's a pretty high minimum.
Well, it's an irreducible minimum. It's very like a lawyer talk type of stuff. But again, it begs the question,
you can't get small is what it's saying.
Irreducible. Yes. They cannot get, yes, it's the lowest amount of people they can have there because they don't have enough to actually convict them of anything. And they run the risk of these people actually not getting off because they don't have enough evidence. But they're positive, supposedly, that these people are dangerous and can't just be left back out into the world now.
So by definition, it would be minimum Guantanamo Bay then?
Minimum Guantanamo Bay?
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Why not? Again, it's a gray area because they can't try them. So to ship a lot of the Republicans are not going to allow people to be shipped into like American prisons, like on American soil. But to keep Guantanamo Bay open, I think it's just going to invite, God knows, the terrifying possibility of a President Donald Trump of filling the prison back up again. So you're in this really bad situation where you have this house of horrors on fucking Cuba and there's nothing you can do about it. I think you have to just find whatever way possible to just get them into American prisons. That's it. That's really the route. I don't think it's going to happen with Obama, but I think that's really the only thing you can do, because leaving Guantanamo Bay open is a calling card for terrorists. It's just asking people to look at that situation and see how brutal the American regime has been and want to fight against that. And again, it's inviting problems when you have a President Trump in office or whatever, 20 years down the road, another Republican, to try to throw people back in there. So you have to find a way to do it. But I think it's going to be the next president's problem.
So, as you know, Hillary has been calling on Obama's administration and all of that. So would she just continue?
What do you mean? What has she been calling on him? What do you mean?
From what I understand, she's been trying to say if she gets reelected, it would be an extension
Yes, it's Obama's third term, essentially.
Yeah, so how would Obama's third term deal with this issue? They're still stuck.
Yeah, well, right. And that's the bullshit thing about Hillary Clinton that we've talked about extensively throughout the process. Like, we don't really need a third Obama term. We need something more liberal than that. We need something more progressive than that. Obama did fine. I think Obama's a C-B-plus president. You know what I mean? It's like, he did good. To me, when Obama's in office, I didn't necessarily feel like we were all going to get killed at any moment. There's a lot of things that he did that I wish he had gone harder or farther on. There's a lot of things that he did militarily that I wish he didn't do at all. But that being said, I don't feel like he's, you know, it's not an immediate danger like a Trump would be or fucking Sarah Palin, you know, scary. Now, to that point, Hillary knows that the general public doesn't look into these things that deeply. They look at some of the social stuff that Obama did. They're not really concerned about war or drones or any of this stuff. And she knows that she could just jump on board with that. She was involved in the administration and saying, yeah, I'm just going to continue the Obama legacy and we'll do better. Like, that's it. That's all she's got to say. And it's a good move. I don't agree with her. And I don't think that's what we necessarily need, but I think people are going to get on board with that. And it's probably smart on her part, particularly through the primary process, because, you know, Bernie was in the untenable situation of attacking the record of the last Democratic president, the first black president. Like, a whole generation of people grew up supporting Obama and voting for him. So Bernie was in the position of being like, not good enough. But that Hillary can just pivot on that and be like, what are you talking about? It's great. And, you know, so that's why you do that. So it's a political calculation. We'll see, but it's going to be her problem, I think.
So Guantanamo Bay doesn't close until they all die naturally.
If irreducible minimum is the right way to put that, then yeah. Yes. I mean, unless they're going to move them to an American prison or somebody's willing to take them elsewhere or whatever, take them off our hands. Yeah, they're going to be there until they die.
See, this is what I would call in the UN.
Uh-huh.
And have them do us a favor.
Yeah, we don't really want to involve you know, global organizations like that, because we're in violation of a lot of the rules of law.
Oh, so we get screwed.
Yeah, there's just no reason to open up that. Nope, this is our problem. We're going to have to deal with it in time. So we'll just have to see what happens with Guantanamo Bay.
Thank God for foreign soil.
Amen, brother. Hey guys, this is Chris, one of the producers here at Stand Up New York Labs, and I'm telling you to go check out our Instagram page, at Stand Up NY Labs. We're having a great time taking pictures of all the comics that come into the studio, recording podcasts, all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. You're missing out if you're not following us. You can see pictures of Jared Fried, Mark Norman, Joe List, Kurt Metzger. Who doesn't need more pictures of Kurt Metzger in their life? Go check out our Instagram page, at Stand Up NY Labs. You're going to love it. Hey, Joey.
Yeah, buddy, what's up?
You want to talk about Joe Biden's bad news on gun control?
Why is it always bad news?
Because, you know what, Joey? It's a good news, bad news world, and today we have some bad news stuff. On Tuesday, flying very counter to the claims of NRA psychotic Jennifer Baker, the horrible shill, Vice President Joe Biden... Do you remember Jennifer Baker from last week? I'm not crazy about her. Vice President Joe Biden admitted defeat on passage of stricter federal gun laws, saying we're probably not going to get much more done in the next 9 months.
Oh, are you crapping me?
No. He urged, quote, don't quit on this, and touted smart guns as a game changer. Jerk-off Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was endorsed by the NRA last week, just for a point of reference. Thoughts, Joey?
Yay, Trump.
Joey, how many guns are there in the U.S., do you think?
300 million. We have a gun for each person.
Yeah, okay, very good.
You get a gun. You get a gun. You get a gun.
Joey, you did your research. I'm very impressed.
That's a shit ton of guns. I really think we should have some initiative to remove maybe about all of them.
Yeah, I mean, replace, right? Replace the guns with... smart guns, that's probably the right way to go. I mean, I think the smart gun thing is something that should definitely stay in the public consciousness and be something that we, you know, keep talking about. And I bring this up because it was not last week we were talking about this fucking Jennifer Baker at the NRA being like, Obama's unstoppable war on guns. Like, he'll stop it. No, they quit. Biden's like, we got 9 months left. But like, I don't think so.
We're done, man. With it.
Yeah, we're done. We're not going to get anything done. They're not taking guns away. They're not restricting guns. It's just such a crazy meme, you know?
Maybe they're saying they're done and they're going to sneak it in.
Obama?
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The old end around or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The gun around?
The gun around. The old reach around. Excuse me. It's a little blue. No, I mean, they're not. And that's the thing. Like, really, the reason I bring it up is because there's this whole conspiracy, right-wing conspiracy, that Obama, like, hates guns and he wants to compensate your... Like, no, he's not doing anything. He can't get anything done. He's mentioning it, but nothing's happening.
Okay. Could we go down this logical path for a second?
I would love to.
Okay. Obama takes the guns away.
Uh-huh.
How is that an issue? You can't protect your family? Protect your family from what?
Well, okay, let's assume that Obama can take your guns away. Okay
so he's going to take away the
which
guns.
Which I don't even think is barely possible, but okay. But all right, Obama takes the guns. Yeah, the problem is, again, I think the original interpretation is that if the government becomes so big and overbearing, the people have the ability to fight, form a militia and mm-hmm. fight a revolution against the government. Yeah, and then beyond that, being self-sufficient, being able to go hunt, protect your family, different things like that. Sure. That is the concern. And to an extent, a legitimate concern. I mean, if you're a hunter and you want to kill your own food and like only eat stuff that you kill and all that type of stuff, yeah, then you obviously need a gun.
Protecting
your property too. I don't have a problem with if you come into my house dead.
I'm pretty sure we don't have 300 million hunters in this country.
I don't think we do either. I think you're absolutely right. No, I, of course. Well, and again, 300 million guns doesn't mean we have 300 million people with one gun.
No, you There's just have 10 people with all the guns.
Yeah, exactly right. There's 10 people with 30 million guns each. Yeah. No, right. I mean, but yeah, I mean, the whole idea that Obama's going to be able to come in and take your gun. Like, first of all, you're not going to be able to fight off the guard. In a situation where the government wants to take over and wants to get your gun, they're going to get it because the military, they have the military. Mm-hmm. And people can pretend all day, and I'm sure there's guaranteed the majority of people in the military wouldn't accept an order to attack their fellow citizens. But I promise you, just human nature and the way things work and the way people can, you know, get stuck in a certain ideology, there's a percentage of people in the military that would fire on their own people. Definitely. There is. I'm sorry if that's a controversial thing to say, but I really believe that. Probably not most, but maybe 2 out of 10, right? 1 out of 10. That's plenty. How many people are in the military? A couple million? All you need is 150,000 people. You could definitely take over the country as the military. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't want to go down that path.
No, I don't either. But you're not going to stop that by having your guns. By the same token, that's not going to happen. They're not going to send them in to take your guns. So you don't really have to worry about it.
Not to mention, if you actually think about it, we're talking about
wait, before you go. Yeah. I love when you go, if you actually think about it, that's the big problem with this country. Not a lot of people are actually thinking about it. They're just like, nope, that fucking Obama, he's not. Think about it.
Because really, if the government's biggest concern is taking a handgun away from you, why would they have a goddamn tank?
Yeah. Well, right, of course. It's even military-style weapons. It's like, yeah, okay, you might have 10 of those.
Yeah, especially when, like, a video came up, like, Gamergate, sorry, I had to bring it up.
Oh, son of a
bitch. SWAT somebody.
Yeah.
That SWAT team is insane.
Yeah, well, swatting someone when you call a SWAT team to somebody's house, right, over video game ethics. No, of course. Well, obviously, right. We're constantly talking about the militarization of police. Like, what are you going to do, really?
No, you can't.
Yeah. If the government and the military specifically want to come in and take your shit, they're going to. And they don't even have to. They can just blow up your fucking house. They have missiles.
Oh.
Well, right. It's out of a bygone era that people think they're going to be able to defend themselves against the military. Look at the fucking Mahler County Refuge, the Oregon protesters.
Yeah.
Those guys, they had a lot of guns. What happened?
You know, that did not go as bad as it could have went.
Absolutely, you're right.
So we kind of dodged a bullet on that one.
Some of us did. Lavoie Finicum ate a few and unfortunately is dead now, but yeah.
That was his own undoing, though.
Well, you know, I mean, we don't have to relitigate the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I understand why they shot him, but I also would have completely understood why they didn't have to kill him, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
But okay, we don't have to get into the whole thing. But right, but yes, that easily could have escalated way worse, and it didn't. Let's get into NFL paid patriotism update, because I'm excited about this one. I saw it and I was like, oh, the Samsonites are going to like this one.
It's not enough money.
I agree with you. On Thursday, the NFL agreed to pay back, I'm not going to say the amount of money, of taxpayer money for inappropriate instances of, quote, sponsored patriotism. I will say the number, obviously, but I'm just skipping it for now because you said it's not enough and I agree. Between 2011 and 2014, the Department of Defense spent $5.4 million on NFL patriotism ceremonies. Between 2012 and 2015, $53 million of taxpayer money, of government money, went to 122 pro sports teams. Evan, if you had to guess, $53 million was spent from 2012 to 2015 to 122 sports teams for paid patriotism ceremonies. How much money did the NFL pay back to taxpayers that was heralded as like, oh, this is a positive step. Good for them. They're doing the right thing. What amount of money?
Can I give a percentage?
No, you have to give a number.
A dollar amount.
$10 million.
Okay. Joey, do you know the amount?
I know the amount.
The amount is $723,734. That's the amount of money that they paid back.
700,000.
Let's even round it. Let's give them the benefit of that. 750. That's what they gave back. After $50 million of taxpayer money at least was spent honoring the troops, which is like the most disrespectful thing you can do, is to be like, oh, yeah, he lost his leg in Iraq. We'll pretend to care about him. Let him trot out onto the field. Like, get the fuck out of here. I hate that shit. And what kind of a victory is this? Is this a victory?
Nope.
Yeah, no way. There's been a lot of talk about, aren't they like NFL sports teams counted as nonprofits or something like that?
I don't know. That's something I'd have to look into, but I wouldn't be shocked by that. I mean, the NFL is like probably one of the most corrupt, you know, organizations in the world for sure.
Yeah, no.
And you can quote me on that. What?
You want to infiltrate the NFL?
Nope.
Okay.
All right. So anyway, I wanted to bring that up. I think we talked about this on MSP 31. I'm not sure if that's, I know we talked about it on MSP 31, but I'm not sure if that was the first instance or not. But listen, Samsonites, you guys can figure it out. But I think we first talked about it on MSP 31. And it was also like an NJ.com like expose about the Jets, essentially.
Yeah, it was.
And
it got
into it. But we talked about it a few times. But MSP 31 for sure. If you want to go check it out, very good. Now, Joey.
Yes.
I got a 2016 update here.
Okay.
I think it's a good one. I feel good lately, and here's why. The election is sort of wound down. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's a little bit of like stuff going on the Democratic side of Nevada, which one of the emails we have potentially at the end of the episode is about that from our man Asar. He's from Sweden.
Nice.
But okay. It's been pretty quiet, I would say, as far as election stuff is concerned. Obviously, California is coming up June 7th.
You have a few weeks where there's no primaries.
Right.
But there would have been Republican primaries, but Donald Trump by default wins them.
Yeah.
And has claimed enough delegates to be considered the official nominee.
Yeah. Well, because Ted Cruz couldn't seal the deal and he blew it. And there you go. So, yeah. But anyway, but my point being, it's nice. You can kind of pay attention to some other stuff that's going on. You kind of clear your head mm-hmm. and just gear up for what is guaranteed to be an embarrassing year or so in American politics with the two most hated candidates of all time going head to head.
That's not what's going to happen. I told you, California is going to save the country.
I really, really hope so. The DNC, Joey, the Democratic National Committee, is giving Bernie Sanders a larger than usual role in shaping party platform at the convention. The 15-member committee will be decided upon. Now, this is the committee that is going to say, we're the Democrats. Mm-hmm. This is our platform. These are the goals that we're going to try to work towards. This is what we stand for.
So you're telling me that every 4 years,
yeah,
they decide what the platform is a couple months before the grand election.
Well, of course, the campaign shapes that, right? And which yeah. is why Bernie's being included. But yes, I mean, generally, I mean, it's not going to vary that much. We're like, you know, 4 years ago, we really wanted to like make polar bears the king. But this year, we're just going to talk about, you know, gun reform. It's like, no, it's not going to vary that much.
Okay.
But okay, the 15-member committee, Hillary gets to pick six. Mm-hmm. Bernie gets to pick five.
Ooh.
And Democratic National Committee Chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz gets four. I hate Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I always have. And
I'm pretty sure last year she had 15. So this is huge.
Well, here's the thing. The establishment still gets two-thirds of the committee because Hillary and Debbie Wasserman Schultz are like right up, you know, tied at the hip. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is so in the bag for Hillary. She's terrible. She didn't even want this job. I remember, if I'm remembering correctly, when they were trying to pick who wanted to be the Democratic you know, chairman,
uh-huh.
she didn't want it, but they were like, no, you're doing it. And she's a big Hillary person. So, okay, but good. At least they give Bernie a little bit of a say-so on that committee. He is expected to name to uh-huh. the committee Representative Keith Ellison, who's a Democrat from Minnesota. He's a Muslim leader.
Okay.
He's progressive. I don't particularly like him because he comes across as ingenuine. He's been on like Bill Maher's program a bunch. I've seen him interviewed him many mm-hmm. times. He doesn't come off as authentic as Bernie does, but I think he still will champion the right causes, essentially. Mm-hmm. But he'll be swayed by public opinion for sure.
Is he the one that's pro-Palestine and that's why everyone's freaking out?
James Zogby, who's a DNC member, he's pro-Palestine.
Oh, he's the one who's pro-Palestine.
Well, listen, and again, it's like pro-Palestine. What does that mean? Does it mean he hates Jews? No, it just means that he thinks that the Palestinians are getting continually beaten down and really have no prospects, even though, yes, I understand there is a terrorist aspect to the tactics of Palestine, but let's get real. We talked about this a billion times. Israel's a superpower that is essentially keeping an entire country of people in bondage, which is wrong, and something needs to be done about that. And the only thing that's going to be done about that to make anything really happen is Israel conceding some power and conceding some ground. And then if the attacks keep happening, then fine. Then you have a legitimate argument. But I hate that thing where this guy can't, everybody's freaking out because he's pro-Palestine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he should be. Doesn't mean he hates Israel. It just means you can objectively look at the situation and be like, yeah, but look at the size of that guy. Look what it's doing to that person. Like, look what it's doing to that kid. Yeah, that's what's happening.
Yeah, it's kind of like David and Goliath.
It's worse because David wins eventually. James Zogby is on that list. Environmental activist Bill McKibben is also on there. He's just another, you know, activist type of guy. Mm-hmm. Dr. Cornel West, who, in my opinion, that's the best pick he made. Bernie Sanders, my brother. That's not a good Cornel. Good.
It was pretty. He needs to stop with the brother thing, though.
I think brother Bernie.
It's a little too much. Sometimes.
It's too much.
Brother, sister Hillary.
There you go. That's pretty good. I like.
Can you get the audio for that for next week?
Yeah, I could probably try to do it right now.
Okay.
Yeah, Cornel West is cool. I like him. Obviously, he's a social justice type of guy, racial justice.
What's
he's
known
a
for?
Radical Christian. You know, like he's a humanist. This guy. He's been a big Bernie supporter. He's known for a lot of things.
I mean, so he's a reverend then.
No, he's a doctor. He's written books. He's a professor. He's he is Christian, you know, but he's whatever. I like Cornel West. He's cool. And a Native American activist, Deborah Parker, which that's a nice thing, I think, to include on this. I mean, Bernie certainly hit a lot of, you know, he hit a broad spectrum of people here, which I think is why people like him to begin with. It's like he's not necessarily forcing the diversity on you, but this is a diverse group of people that are all sort of geared towards the same ideology, which I think is interesting. Let's see. What can I do here? This is Cornel West on Bernie Sanders and the TPP. Let's just see. This is a random clip I'm playing. Just so you can hear what Cornel West sounds like. Dr. Cornel West. Oh, come on, this whole intro. Can you believe this, Jones?
Yeah, well, that's what you get for randomly clicking.
I know. Here, all right, I'll just skip ahead.
Republicans tonight that you...
Oh, that's you, Hewitt. Oh, here we go.
Real quickly. You see, it's in deep trouble.
A new segment.
Yeah. New segment.
Random click.
Random clips of Cornel West.
Representing working and poor people at his best.
And yet there's an irony this year.
We'll just let him talk about it.
When you look at the two candidates, or even if you include Martin O'Malley, on the Democratic side, three white people. Look who's out front for the Republicans. Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, though he's fading. A black man, two Latinos, as well as, of course, Donald Trump. What does that tell us? Anything at all?
Nope.
Well, I think we know from dear brother Barack Obama.
Okay, thank you, Cornel West. I appreciate it. Okay, so there you go. So you get the idea. But, I mean, he's much more animated for the most part, like when he's on a Bill Maher show or whatever. No, brother Bill! You know, he's very, like, that type of guy. But he's cool. I like Cornel West. All right. So that's that. I also have some Bernie quotes in the email. Bernie has been fighting words, I feel like, a little bit lately. Bernie Sanders, the current situation is undemocratic, and it is ill-advised. Some 400 of Hillary Clinton's superdelegates came on board her campaign before anybody else announced. It was an ointment, and that is bad for the process. That's what Bernie had to say. He's right.
You know what I think? I think we should come up with a way that they have to get all the superdelegates to say that they're actually with Hillary.
What do you mean?
Before the convention.
Yeah.
Whether counting or like she has so many superdelegates.
Right.
But I didn't see them... super delegates say I vote for Hillary or I want Hillary.
Oh yeah, but I think there's a mechanism at the convention where they will register as like I'm a super delegate for Hillary. Like they throw in their, you know, their
so
vote.
So you're gonna see a massive pivot.
I don't think so.
You're gonna see 600 people pivot all at the same time.
You're so sweet. I really do love that you're just like an undying optimist. This is another Bernie Sanders quote. Excuse me. Oh come on. Excuse me. I really like this quote. We need a campaign, an election coming up, which does not have two candidates who are really very, very strongly disliked. I don't want to see the American people voting for the lesser of two evils. I want the American people to be voting for a vision of economic justice, of social justice, of environmental justice, of racial justice. That is the campaign we are running, and that is why we are getting the support we are. ABC host George Stephanopoulos asked Sanders if he would describe Trump and Clinton as the lesser of two evils. Well, if you look, no. I wouldn't describe it, but that's what the American people are saying. If you look at the favorability ratings of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, both of them have very, very high unfavorables. Yeah, they are the lesser of two evils, Bernie. You know, that's exactly what it is.
That's exactly what it
means. You know, so it's like he's picking his words there, but clearly that is the situation that we're in, where it's like, can't let that bitch become president, can't let that fucking asshole become president, and that's the reason why people are voting for the other person.
Do you know what it seems to me? Everything he just said about justice and all this.
Yeah.
It's too expensive.
Justice?
Mm-hmm.
Justice, there is a too high a price on justice. Yes. For sure. Absolutely. In this country, there absolutely is. Economic, like he's talking about, economic justice, social justice, racial justice. Yeah, the price is simply too high because we don't have a system designed to accommodate that. We have to change that stuff. You're absolutely right, Joey. Great point. A Morning Consult survey published Tuesday had Hillary Clinton at 38, Donald Trump at 35, and Libertarian Gary Johnson at 10.
Who the hell is Gary Johnson?
We're going to get into it, with 17% undecided. A mid-March Monmouth poll had Hillary at 42, Trump at 34, and Gary Johnson at 11. Libertarian convention takes place this weekend in Orlando. It's something we're going to pay attention to, and we'll talk about it next week. Johnson will face Austin Peterson and John McAfee.
I brought him up. Yay! McAfee.
Who the prime minister of Belize once called, quote, extremely paranoid and bonkers. Those are the three guys that are going to run to get the nomination of the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party is already established being on the ballot in all 50 states. So he will...
Can they put up anyone they want?
Yes, they are their own party. They secured the ballot and the ballot in all the states. So whoever they run. So if they decide to run you, Joey, you'd be on the ballot in 50 states.
I think this is the time where somebody goes... They can only run one candidate, right?
Yeah, they're going to run Gary Johnson. But the point is, the Green Party's running. This is what I'm saying. This is what gets interesting. Who is Gary?
But it's not a big enough name. Like, if they could do, like, Biden or something.
Yeah, but why would Biden run as an independent on the Libertarian? He's a Democrat. He's a progressive. He's a social Democrat. You know, it's like,
Hillary can't get the job done.
Let me ask you these questions. I understand what you're saying, but let me ask you these questions. Who Gary Johnson's a libertarian. Now, if you said, who the hell is Gary Johnson?
Yeah.
Great question. Gary Johnson has been in a few of the debates, not this year, but in previous elections he's been involved. Mm-hmm. He was the governor of New Mexico. He's a libertarian candidate, and he's been involved in politics for quite a while. He's for the legalization of marijuana. He's an interesting guy. He was just on the Joe Rogan podcast. Go check that out. It's like a 2.5-hour conversation with Gary Johnson. I've seen him talk before. I've heard him talk in a number of different places. This is a good introduction to it because Rogan's a good interviewer. He leans libertarian in certain cases, and it was an honest conversation. Check it out if you'd like to know more about Gary Johnson.
But here's my issue with the whole thing.
Let me just wrap my point. I would say that I agree, like same with Rand Paul. Rand Paul kind of rides the line of being, and Ron Paul certainly was a libertarian. I agree with them probably 35% of the time. I can get on board with some libertarian ideas. I'm not a conservative Republican by any means. I can get on board with certain libertarian ideas. At a certain point, you lose me because I do think the government has an important role and that it's not just going to fuck up and be a problem. But I can get on board with some libertarian things. So, good. You were going to say something, then I have a question.
All right. So, the big deal with Donald Trump and the amazing campaign he's run, a lot of it is based on name recognition. So if that's the case...
And same can be said about Hillary.
Okay. So you have name recognition. So why hasn't the Libertarian Party been more active in trying to get out one said Johnson's name?
Well, first of all, because he's not the nominee yet. So they have other candidates. But let's assume Gary Johnson's going to come because it's not that fucking easy. You know how much money it costs to get name recognition? Donald Trump's
Have social media and all these tools that Donald Trump had access
to. Then why don't you have name recognition? You have access to those tools. I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm really asking. Like, think about it that way. Like, why does Donald Trump have millions and millions of followers on Twitter and that type of access?
His name's on buildings.
Yeah, his name's on buildings. He's been in the public, sphere for 30, 40 years. His name is associated with it. He had a TV show. Right, of course. So that's why. I mean, it's not that easy. If it was that easy, a lot of people would be doing it. And Hillary, she has name recognition because she's been around for fucking forever. Her husband was the president, Clinton. Like, that's why. Then now, that being said, 10%, 11% in the poll, that's a lot. That's a lot for somebody that you've never heard of, potentially. Evan, you ever heard of Gary Johnson?
No.
Okay, I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't. It's the same kind of idea as Jill Stein. Why is that a bad vote? Don't vote for the lesser of two evils. Vote for who you support. My question is, who would Gary Johnson, assuming he's going to be the nominee and he's going to be on all 50 ballots, all 50 states ballots, and Jill Stein's going to be involved, who are they going to steal support from? Are people that don't like Hillary or are disillusioned with Hillary, are they going to vote for Gary Johnson? Or is he going to be pulling from the same portion of people that Trump is trying to get, and it's going to turn into a Ross Perot type of situation, and Hillary just fucking runs away with the whole thing? That's the interesting thing.
I think it would come down to Jill Stein and him pulling more away from Hillary than pulling away from Trump.
Well, Jill Stein is certainly going to pull more away from Hillary. If you're going under the assumption that people that, did Bernie steal support from Hillary, and now that Bernie's out, will they refuse to go back to Hillary?
Oh, wouldn't that be something?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. I think there's a lot of people that weren't going to vote. They love Bernie. Bernie's out. So they weren't going to vote for Hillary anyway. So they'll vote for Jill Stein, who's closer to Bernie, or they just won't vote. People that already supported Hillary are just going to keep supporting Hillary. It's not like Trump is going to steal any Hillary supporters. That's insane. Or Bernie supporters. That's a nonsense thing. That just doesn't make any sense. Gary Johnson is a libertarian, so that would kind of factor into the Republican voter base. We'll see. It's an interesting thing. I don't think Trump's going to win the election anyway, but Gary Johnson polling really well and being out there, you know, it is a big deal, especially if you get to a situation where he's polling that high, 10, 12, he get up to like 14%. You got to include that guy in a debate now.
He does getting, he would have to be.
He would have to be. If he's polling 10%, how are you going to be like, well, now, because they're only polling 30 something percent. You know what I mean? It's like, well, what do you want him to do?
And the fact that they're hated that much.
Right. It becomes a viable, a legitimately viable third
because
party.
Because all those people who hate them have to go someplace.
Absolutely, or just drop out. But the other thing becomes, what if then the Republicans do decide to run a third party that becomes even a fourth party? Now you're in a situation where you got Hillary, Trump, Gary Johnson, a fourth Republican running, potentially Romney. Like, what,
I don't
what
think
a
they have enough
time
to set up the ballots, though.
They could figure it out. Well, because they're the because they just say Trump isn't our candidate. You know what I mean? Like, there's shit that can be done. Romney could just become the Republican candidate. Oh, so and Trump's running. You know what I mean? It's like there's a lot to be done.
So you're saying that at the convention, even though he is the nominee, they just say we're going to go with somebody else.
Highly unlikely, but it's possible. There's enough money that could back Romney to get him on the ballot. They figure it out. You know what I mean? Plus, well, whatever. But anyway, but yeah, okay. That's just purely speculative. But the point being, Gary Johnson polling that well is interesting. And look, it's worth listening to what Gary Johnson has to say the same way it's worth listening to Jill Stein and everybody. I don't agree necessarily with Gary Johnson, but it's interesting that there's a third voice out there. That's what we want to see. We want to see four or five viable candidates.
See, because the other thing, too, is the way Twitter is set up and Facebook and everything is set up, that could project him in a month's time to have all eyes on him.
Yes, absolutely, because it becomes a novelty thing. Like, there's a lot of people who go, who?
Who?
Of course, there's going to be a huge percentage of people that are like, I don't, you know, they don't pay attention anyway, so yes, they hear a name them. And it just doesn't register. But yeah, for sure, the social media aspect could be a benefit to him, and he's going to have the whole backing of the Libertarian
Party,
so that's, you know, that's important. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes. But it's something we're going to keep our eye on, definitely. Meanwhile, we're almost done with this update. On Wednesday, the State Department's Inspector General's report found that Hillary Clinton broke government rules by using a private email server without approval.
So the keyword was broke, right?
Yes. She didn't tell them she was going to do that. So that's the first report that came out. So she said, yeah, they said it was fine. And they're like, she didn't fucking ask us whether she could do that or not. What other people are saying is that the system in place to even ask to do something like that is so shitty in the State Department that the record keeping, all that stuff, it's not really going to hold up that well.
No, of course.
But, okay, so that's at least a report that comes out. This is the thing that keeps lingering. How much is it going to hurt her? How much are people really paying attention to? I don't know. How much do people that actually support her give a shit? I don't think that there's a huge... There's not a huge crossover between people that were going to support her and now hate her because of the emails, and people that were never going to support her and would always hate her about anything she did. Forget the emails, you know?
It doesn't matter if she broke the law, because unless if they're going to arrest her on it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it only hurts her in terms of favorability of, like, she's untrustworthy. But they're both untrustworthy.
Nice.
Finally, this is an interesting one. President Barack Obama's approval ratings are the highest they've been since his second inauguration. You don't know what you got till it's gone. People are into him again. 88% of Democrats support him. 8% of Republicans. Ridiculous. 50 plus percent of independents support and approve of President Obama's job right now. Obviously, because when you look, it's like, oh, Christ, Hillary and Trump.
Do we have a poll that says, well, most of those independents are going to go?
I don't believe there's even a real thing as independents. Again, the real independents in this whole thing were people that came out of the woodwork and were going to vote for Bernie. Otherwise, there's no real such thing as an independent. For real. I just don't believe it. How could you live your life that way? You might not be registered Democrat, Republican, but you're not living your life just like, well, wait and see. Like, you're just an idiot that's an independent. You have a feeling one way or another. There's no way to look at the Republican Party, even just on a handful of issues, social, whatever, versus the Democratic Party, and be like, I really don't know. Like, that's because you're a dum-dum, but you definitely are going to vote one way or the other. You're not a real independent.
Unless if you have, like, millions of people cherry-picking issues.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
you know, cherry picking issue. Like maybe they want abortion but don't like the gays, or you know.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You're not represented that way, and there's always going to be the one issue that trumps all of them, whether it's your taxes, whether it is, whether you are gay and you want to get married, so there's no way you can vote for Trump. You're Mexican, you're not going to vote for Trump. You know what I mean? There's always going to be one thing that you're like, yeah, I would, but no, I can't because that one, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's just how it works. The abortion thing is a huge, so that's my point. There's no real, you can pretend to be independent, but you're not really independent because you're obviously going to pick one of the two.
You're leaning away.
Yeah. I'm an independent in the sense that I'm liberal, right? Pretty liberal. Mm-hmm. I support a lot of progressive ideas. I can get on board, like I said, with libertarian ideas, certain conservative ideas. But I'm not. I don't have a dog in this game. It was Bernie. He's out. So now I'm just a conscientious observer in this whole process. You know what I mean? If you really want to be an independent, vote for a third party. If you're voting for one of the two major parties, you're not an independent. You're just an undecided Democrat or Republican so far. But you're going to vote for one of them. All right, pretty good discussion, Joey. Any final thoughts on the 2016 update? Anything there? Or should we get to email from a hat?
600 people pivot, bro.
Okay, so you're calling it right now.
Yes.
Bernie will win this thing.
Bernie is going to be nominated at the convention.
I really hope so. I refuse to keep arguing with you about it. I really hope that happens.
California is going to speak loud and clear.
All right, we'll just have to see about that. All right, Joe, should we get into email from a hat, or should we do our little outro stuff first and then close the show with that?
Let's do the outros.
Guys, you can go on iTunes. You can rate, subscribe, review this podcast. It helps us move up the charts. We really appreciate your support there. You can also go on soundcloud.com/mandatorySamson. You can leave a comment on the episode. Me and Joey both respond to those. Me more than Joey, but I try to stay on top of him and let him do that. And by stay on top of him, let him do that, I mean I literally lay on top of Joey while he responds to your comments. Yeah. You can also find us on Google Play for all of our Android users. I'm an Android user, Joey.
I love Android.
All right, me too. You guys can find us on there. YouTube.com/mandatorySamson. I put up full episodes every week. Right now we're changing certain things over here at Stand Up New York Lab, so we don't have our video set up right now, but we are going to start doing that. Right now I'm just putting up the audio only with a graphic on YouTube. If you guys like to listen on there, have at it. You can also email us mandatorysamson@gmail.com. On Twitter, I'm @mansamp. On Snapchat, I'm @mansamp. On Instagram, I'm @mansamp. Joey is Joey from Jersey. Jersey spelled with a Z on Twitter and Snapchat. We love you guys. We really appreciate you listening to the program. And now, for the first installment of
Emails from a Hat.
Woo! Evan's going to come over here with a hat. Evan, did you throw in the pieces of paper in there we're going to pick? He's nodding yes. Joey.
Okay.
Now, pick it. Don't say what you picked out.
Okay.
Joey's picking a piece of paper out. We had three emails this week that I threw into the hat, and that's going to form the basis of, you know, the rest of this as we go along. 1, 2, 3. I numbered them randomly, and now Joey just picked a number out of the hat. Joey, what number did you pull out?
4.
Nope.
Okay. It's 1.
It's 1?
It's 1.
Okay, very good. So this is an email from Evan, and this is how we're going to close the show. Hey, Chris, like the podcast so far and love that you're just left of center, because I think anyone who's so far off to either political poll is a total idiot. Evan, let me tell you this. You need to keep listening to the podcast, because I think I'm way farther left than you think, but I appreciate that. Have to disagree with you on the USA chant being semi-white supremacist, though, and let me explain. The chant is simple and 3 syllables long. It's not anything silly and long like, I believe that we will win. When it's chanted at international sporting events, I feel like it's not so much done out of American pride as it is to troll the opposing fans, especially when it's done as a sport which the U.S. isn't the best at. Examples, hockey and soccer. The fans are basically saying, we want the U.S. to win, but we don't care if we lose because we're still the U.S. The U.S. could be losing 5-0 in a soccer game, and the USA chant would still be effective. Also, it can be used to make fun of any dumb idea of American origins, like fast food, movies, or porn, or whatever. It's such an awesomely versatile chant. So take it easy on the USA chant. Yes, I guess it can be used to taunt non-Americans sometimes, but for the most part, it's just a dumb, fun thing to yell when people are drinking. Evan, thank you, Evan. We appreciate it. Joey, thoughts on this?
How much drinking is involved?
A lot, I gotta say. I mean, that is usually a factor in the USA chants, I gotta feel like. Here's my thing about the whole point. And Evan, I think you were the one that brought up the white supremacist angle on this whole thing, right?
Yeah, that was a buzzword, definitely.
No, but look, I agreed with you at the time, and I still agree with you. It is.
I think under certain circumstances, like, he's right, and I think he made a good case about the sporting events, how highly versatile it is when it's used. But that's exactly the point. And I guess based on certain experiences that are not in a sporting event, like, it is used for the perverse reasons we talked about.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, I mean, I brought up the UFC as an example. Like, when there's, mm-hmm. you know, Stipe Miocic is the current heavyweight champion of the UFC. He sounds like he's from wherever. I forget. I think he's, I want to say Croatian, but I'm not, whatever. I don't mm-hmm. remember. But he's from Ohio. So it's not, you know, but people might chant USA, USA, like, as a taunt against him. But he's American also. So it doesn't matter. But anyway, so that's... I understand, but I also understand it as just a fun thing to chant. I get totally the point about, like, troll, like, we're the U.S., like, it's great. It's the same argument, though, about the Confederate flag, where a lot of people go, it's Southern pride. Yeah, but it's also a white supremacist symbol. Well, this is an argument that we've had on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. Same kind of idea. I do understand that it is not in all cases being used maliciously or as a symbol of white supremacy or whatever, but I don't know, just like the weird... If it's done tongue-in-cheek, it's one thing, but it's hard to decipher that from just a chant, like, as it being like, oh, they're joking with that chant. It does seem like this weird, like, kind of nationalism that, I don't know, I just don't get on board with, but, you know.
Where do you think would be the most inappropriate place to do a USA chant?
Probably the death of a foreign leader, yeah. all right, very good. I think that's how we're going to end the show. Good question, Joey. Evan, thank you for producing the program, for contributing.
Always.
Joey? I love you, buddy. Thank you. I think this was a fun episode.
Yes, it was.
And you know what? I love the Samsonites, too. We're going to do this email from a hat. I think it's nice. I think it's better. I promise to Asar and David, we have your emails. They're on tap. They're going to be put back into the hat. Everybody else that emails, their shit will be thrown into the hat as well. And we're going to answer questions at the end of the podcast. I think it's a nice way to end it up.
You know, one day we might need a really big hat.
Like one of those, like you pull the lottery numbers out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah,
those
yeah.
big cylinders. Yeah, absolutely. Stay tuned for that. We love you guys. This has been another fun episode, and we will most certainly be back for another one next week. We'll talk to you then.
This has been a Stand Up Labs production, powered by Digital Media. Subscribe to new and archive episodes wherever